Support for today's broadcast comes from the licensed professionals at Body Therapy Shop, dedicated to helping clients relieve stress-induced muscle or joint pain with therapeutic massage, body work, and physical therapy services. Located in the Lincoln Square Village, Urbana, with more information on the web at bodytherapyshop.com.
It's 2:40. In sports, the city of Chicago is getting a high-profile boost in its bid to host the 2016 Summer Olympics. Beijing medalists Michael Phelps and Kobe Bryant are among 150 U.S. Olympic athletes gathered in a downtown park for the taping of Oprah Winfrey's season premiere. The athletes were introduced under a shower of red, white, and blue confetti as thousands of spectators cheered them on. The Chicago White Sox have avoided being swept by Cleveland for the first time in more than 2 years. They played the finale of a three-game series at Progressive Field today. The Sox came out the winners 4-2. Ryan Dempster will try again to log his career-high 16th win when he takes the mound for the Chicago Cubs tonight. The Cubs are trying to avoid a three-game sweep by the surging Houston Astros that would also be Chicago's season-high 5th consecutive loss overall. The St. Louis Cardinals and the Arizona Diamondbacks play the deciding game of their series in Phoenix this afternoon. The Cards are 5.5 games behind Milwaukee in the NL wild card race. In that game, it's not yet underway. I don't have a score yet, so there you have it. And Illinois will kick off its men's basketball season on November 14th against Eastern Washington. Illinois announced the 2008-2009 schedule today. The team is slated to play its first Big Ten game on December 30th against the Boilermakers of Purdue. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Busey Bank main branch renovation, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:42. America has a love-hate relationship with coal. We burn coal to make half our electricity, but we're always fighting coal's air pollution. Some regulations decimated the coal industry in one key state. Sean Ali reports miners there are caught between a slow comeback and another round of regulation.
Coal was once king of the southern Illinois economy, but no longer. Nathan Threewitt lives in the area. He explains mining jobs evaporated.
18 years ago, give or take a couple, people went from making a nice upper-class living to nothing at all. Couldn't find work. Everybody had to move.
You had that happen in your own family?
Yep. My dad's got 10 brothers and sisters, and they went from everybody had clothes for school, everybody had food to eat, to they didn't know how the hell it was going to happen.
Even though Threewitt has a tough history with coal, he's actually trying to get into the industry. In fact, I find him while he's taking a break from a coal mining training class at Rendlake College. I know at one time classes like these had been canceled. I tracked down instructor David Colombo to see what's changed.
This room is where I train miners for the most part.
Hey, what's this?
This is a high voltage cable.
This is almost as thick as your arm.
This isn't the biggest of the bigs either.
Right now, fewer than 4,000 Illinois miners need to be familiar with equipment like this. But Colombo gets calls from mining companies in the area who need trained workers. So his school is growing to keep up.
Why have faith that you're going to need space for miners to be trained?
I know that the mine permitting that is going on at present time is the highest it's been in 30 years. Gentlemen in this afternoon's class are actually going to start sinking the mine within the next week or two. Right now it just employs 10 people, but about a year from now that same mine is going to employ probably 110 people.
People use words like rebound and comeback when they describe the Illinois coal industry. But how did Illinois coal ever get on its knees in the first place? I mean, coal provides half of the country's power. Didn't we need Illinois coal? To understand what happened, you have to dial back a little.
Well, this is really the effect of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990.
This is John Mead. He heads coal research at Southern Illinois University. He says Illinois coal is blessed with high energy, but it's cursed with sulfur that caused acid rain and lung disease. The amendments aim to cut that.
Most utilities were able to switch to lower sulfur coal, and that's just what they did.
In fact, utilities opened new mines out west where the coal has less sulfur. As for an Illinois coal turnaround,
today, sulfur and other materials in the coal can be managed and controlled pretty effectively with technology.
So now Illinois coal can better compete with lower sulfur coal. But here's the thing. There could be another pollution clampdown in the works. You know about that whole global warming thing, right? Well, carbon dioxide is a big cause, and coal produces carbon dioxide in spades. Scientists say cutting coal emissions would be a quick way to cut carbon. So miners in southern Illinois get mixed messages. The country wants their coal again, but maybe not for long. Miner-to-be Nathan Threewitt says he's thought this through.
Well, if anybody's looked at the economics of it, it's going to go back. Coal used to be $15 a ton. It's now about $65 a ton. It's going to do nothing but go up. You're going to have all these coal companies that's got coal left in the ground. It used to not be worth it to get the money out. Now it's worth it.
You like those odds?
Yeah, I do. I'm rolling the dice on it.
Threewitt figures he's got time to build a career from coal while America makes up its mind just how clean it wants its coal-fired electricity. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
It's 2:46, 73 degrees in Urbana. We know that tune, don't we? Well, here are some names to go with it. Grange, Halas, Grabowski, Butkus. These are four of the football greats that made their names on the field at Memorial Stadium at the University of Illinois. But Memorial Stadium's story involves more than football. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. WILL-TV senior producer John Paul says the story of the stadium is one of true alumni spirit. John Paul is the producer, together with Denise LaGrassa, of the new documentary, Memorial Stadium, True Illini Spirit. The documentary that tells the story of the 85-year-old stadium will premiere next Tuesday night, September 9th at 7 on WILL-TV. The premiere coincides with this Saturday's rededication of the renovated stadium. And John Paul is my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. So what inspired the title, True Illini Spirit?
You know, several things. As we began researching the history of the stadium dating back into the early 20s, you found that there was a spirit of the people not only that played football prior to the building of the stadium, but also those who the athletic director at the time, George Huff. And we kept looking around for something that would capture the essence of the spirit that led to the construction of the stadium. And the marching Illini, as they march out, I guess, I'm not quite sure how to put that, when they perform the 3-1 at halftime, one of the songs near the beginning of the 3-1 is called The March of the Illini. And in that, the band members sing, "We're marching for dear old Illini, for the men who are fighting for you." Well, that's exactly the spirit that led to the stadium. Near the end of those lyrics, they sing, "We are marching and singing in true Illini spirit." And that's where it came from. That's where we really pulled the title from. And it really is the essence of it.
Okay. Well, what do you say we take a listen to the marching Illini performing the lyric? Illini. Now, the stadium opened, as I have it, on November 3rd of 1923.
That was the first game played. The fall of 23, they rushed to get the stadium done for the homecoming game. Stadium wasn't done at that point.
Right.
Only the east and west stands were done. The towers were not done. The horseshoe was not done. None of the landscaping around the stadium was done. In fact, as you'll learn when you watch the documentary next Tuesday night on WILL, Many of the people that went to that game literally lost their shoes and boots in the mud, but went on into the game. The next Monday, as the construction workers came back, they pulled a wagon full, because at that point it was a wagon, a wagon full of shoes and boots out of the mud for people who just left them there. And they had better than 60,000 people at that first game. Of course, the game that everybody remembers was a year later in October of 1924, which was the dedication game in which Red Grange made college football famous.
Yeah, and the game was against?
The University of Michigan.
Right.
We were not expected to win. Michigan and Illinois were both undefeated the previous year in 1923. Michigan expected to literally clean our clocks and said Grange isn't going to be a factor in the game. Well, he ran the opening kickoff back 95 yards and the rest is history.
Yeah. Now, before the game, you know, there were people coming into the stadium and, you know, it hadn't been that long since the war ended. And I wonder what it was like for the people who were among the first to walk into the stadium and see these memorials.
You know, the colonnades on the east and west side are the real memorial aspect of that building. And that's the part that I think many football fans fail to appreciate. They come for the game. They come for the stands. They see those pillars outside, but they don't recognize that each one of them stands for a true Fighting Illini from World War I. At least most of them do. There is a Wolverine column. You'll find out why there's a Michigan Wolverine being honored among the Illini. But for the most part, that's the story that you'll see in the documentary, is we're going to introduce you to one of those Fighting Illini who died in World War I. And I think when they, on the Friday before that dedication game, the veterans were honored. The president of the university, David Kinley, spoke almost like Abraham Lincoln did in consecrating Gettysburg, saying these are hallowed grounds and the spirit of these Illini will always be here. And I think many people would say even today that spirit still resides at the stadium, even above and beyond football games.
Yeah. Well, tell us about some of the people you interviewed and what they had to say about what this place means to them, Memorial Stadium.
Boy, you find it's funny, you know, for a building that you go to only in the fall for football games, it has a lot of feeling, especially for people, I think, that have orange and blue blood. Dick Butkus, who we all remember as being a Bears great, was also an Illini great in the 60s. One of the stories he recalls is, for those of us who have ever walked up the ramps to get to the upper deck, gotten up there and out of breath, Dick told us he used to run the ramps to get physically fit for the games. And, of course, that sounds like Dick Butkus. Red Grange told us, he didn't tell us in an interview that we were able to obtain, Red talked about how he nearly didn't go out for football. Had it not been for his fraternity brothers threatening to paddle him, he wouldn't have gone back and tried out for football. He did, and of course, again, football was changed. The story, Celeste, of a man who was born at the stadium in 1925. Not a man, a baby was born there. But sure. That in and of itself, we think it's probably the only birth to ever occur in a football stadium.
Yeah, and there was a football player who not only played football on the field, but also worked at the stadium.
Right. J.C. Caroline in the early 50s was a star running back for the Illini, led the nation in rushing in 52 or 53, I forget at the moment. And not only did he star on the field, but he was the night watchman for the stadium. And those are things that even surprised us. We interviewed a broadcaster from Decatur who used to do play-by-play of Illini games from the 50s through the 80s. And he surprised us by going, you're not going to believe this, but when I was 5 years old, my dad took me to that 1924 game. And you don't expect that in the middle of an interview.
Yeah. Now, you're a fan and you're an alum. Do you remember your first trip into Memorial Stadium? What were your first impressions?
Yeah, I grew up in Peoria. I came down here as a high school student. My parents brought me down. We went to a game probably in 1970, 69, something of that nature, and just going, this is amazing. I know what I want to do for college. Not play football, but I know where I want to go to school because I want to be part of this environment. Even though the football team at that time was not as strong as I guess it has been in other years, there is something about college football and the pageantry and the way you feel at a game that is unmatched by, I think, any other athletic contest that you might go to. But by the way, you know, you have to remember that building has so much more than athletics. Graduations, commencements used to be held there. Farm Aid was held there.
Right. And the marching band contest every fall.
Yeah, you've been playing a marching Illini music. There was a high school marching contest held there every year. The band is such a huge part of that stadium. At one point, there was a track around the stadium, and NCAA track meets were sometimes held there. It's just an amazing place.
Yeah. Well, we'll be tuning in
Tuesday
next week.
Tuesday at 7 o'clock next week.
Very good. A WILL TV 12 Memorial Stadium, true Illini spirit. John Paul is the producer with Denise LaGrassa of this new documentary that will premiere next Tuesday night, September 9th at 7 on WILL TV.
Earth and Sky.
Greg Simon is the president of a company called Faster Cures, which says it wants to help speed up the development of cures for many diseases. Faster Cures hosts an online portal called Biobank Central. Its goal is to connect biobanks around the world.
A biobank for research on humans is a repository that stores and distributes and maintains DNA, tissue, blood serum. Right now, unfortunately, many people treat their hospital, their research lab's biobank as a very proprietary resource, and they don't like to tell you what's in it until they have a chance to do their own research on it, and that can delay access to the tissue for a long time.
Because human tissue has a short shelf life, that delay might mean the sample is wasted.
And if you had a biopsy of a breast tumor or prostate cancer, the last thing you'd want to find out is that nobody ever used it to further the development of a cure.
The European Union expects to create a widespread network of biobanks. Simon believes that we in the U.S. would benefit from a similar shared system. I'm Lindsay Patterson for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is WILL 580 AM.